Hi, I'm Dave Meltzer, live at the National Restaurant Association show, the biggest show here in Chicago, with the who's who for your stomach. But I have an entrepreneur of $3 billion and more. My man, Matt Ebert, is here with me with Entrepreneurs the Playbook, CEO and founder of Crafts Champions. Welcome to the Playbook.
Thanks, David. Glad to be here.
Well, you know, on the Playbook, I like to get into the Playbook for Success. And nobody knows success better in your space than you. Building a company to over $3 billion, that's with a B, is not easy. Let's start with
lots of non-successes along the way.
And let's talk about that. You know, it took a long time before you started to scale. I think from 99 till 2019, so about, 20 years?
Yeah, just...
You had 13 stores.
Yeah, 2014, I still had just a half a shop. When my partner let me buy him out. So grew it to 13, brought in a private equity investor in 2019, and then really went from there to 650 locations today. So in the last 5 years.
And when you were a half owner, if somebody asked you your playbook, would you have said, oh, this is how it's going to happen, and this is how we're going to get to where I want to be or better?
Yeah, I wouldn't. I never dreamed this big. So then I was just, you know, when it first started, just trying to make a paycheck or get a paycheck that I could actually cash.
Yeah, right. And
then, of course, along the way, the business, we got better at it. It started to make a little money. Then came the goal of buying out my partner. Then came the goal of a couple locations. So, yeah, it isn't anything that I sat down 30 years ago with a playbook already thought through. I've learned along the way and learned to think bigger along the way.
You know, we're limited by our past experiences, the meaning that we give our past experiences. And a lot of those are derived from our family and friends.
Yep.
And so I know even in my situation, which was more accelerated, I was blessed to not have to wait as long, mm-hmm. which caused other issues. But I was constantly fighting my family and my friends with my big dream. So you weren't dreaming big, but I'm curious what your family's role played when you're not playing big.
That's right.
Maybe you know you could be playing big. What was your family and friends' role? Were they in a different mindset? How did they either support or hinder you in your success?
Yeah, unless they've achieved a great deal of success, they're probably not the best advisors, and they mean well.
Yeah, right.
Right. Their encouragement is going to be to play it safe, which is what your own mind does. So very well-meaning friends and family would encourage you not to aim that big. And I feel it comes from a good place. It's coming from them trying to protect you. But it nothing worthwhile really comes without risk. We all know that. So there's going to be a level of risk that most people aren't comfortable with.
But it seems like to me you didn't take the risk until you actually had a family to worry about risk, which is odd, right? Like most guys, when they're in a less risky position, will go ahead and risk more.
Well, to be clear, it was risk all along. I mean, yeah. I cashed in advance $100,000 on credit cards to open up the first business I tried. My upbringing was very, very low middle class.
Yeah.
Lived in rural Illinois. So, and a lot of my drive came from, you know, all those childhood experiences of the answer was no, we can't afford it. And wealth was almost looked down upon, actually. And so the real desire to entrepreneurial stuff came up even in my teenagers. So there was always a level of risk taking. It really is just the bigger things require bigger risk, but I kind of scaled to it.
Yeah, and it is, right? It's like pole vaulting. You know, a pole vaulter, when it goes to 18 feet, it looks impossible.
Yeah.
But he started at 8 feet and he kept learning, and it was actually safer at 18 feet than it was at 8 feet because he just knew so much more. And I say the same thing about scaling a business. I feel a lot safer in the B range with the billions than I did when I was, you know, loading up my credit cards.
That's right.
To get it.
Yeah. It was hard. It's easier to borrow a lot of money today than it was just to borrow $5,000 from me 20 years ago.
I love
trust
that.
Me. So I get it. The thing is like there is a lot of money in the world looking for a good place to go. And so if you get a proven business model that works, you can't attract money. there's things that run in the business that create great challenges. But as long as you can deliver on your promises for lenders and investors, you are able to find money to grow.
One of the things that I'm still fighting or dealing with my family is they come from a lower income space where money was bad. Yeah. You know, people who had money were manipulative, dishonest.
Same thing, yeah.
And in both periods of my life, because I've, you know, ran it up once over $100 million and lost it all, ran it back up. I actually found that my family had greater comfort when I lost everything than when I had over $100 million. Like, my relationships got better again with some of my siblings.
Okay. Have they gotten bad now that you're
they're older now
since the comeback?
But I still feel judgment a lot of times because of not just the wealth, but because of the success. That
okay.
There must be something else in order to get all the blessings I have in my life. I must have done something that was not good, which is really silly because the first time I probably had some maturing to do and my behaviors weren't all good. But the second time around, I really like, it's part of my ethos, man. Like, I'm here to do good.
Do good. And you can function with a clean conscience and be proud of
what you're
doing.
That's why I sleep so well.
Yeah. I mean, same with my business. Here, look, like, we make a couple $100 a car. We just fix a lot of cars.
Yeah.
Like, so there is no getting over on somebody to get ahead. It's not needed. It's not necessary. Perform a good service and do it a lot.
Yeah.
The way to make more money next
other
year
people
is,
aren't.
Yeah. The way to make more money next year is simply fix more cars in my world. It's not how do I got to do something to hurt somebody else. Doesn't work that way.
And there's plenty of cars.
Yeah.
That need to be fixed.
That's right. Yep.
Even autonomous cars get hurt.
Yeah, and the great thing is obviously you've gotten comfortable with it, and you've gotten comfortable with your goals and where you want to go, and I have too. But that doesn't come without kind of the learnings, I think, unless you're fortunate enough to get the right mentors, which I didn't know how to find those kind of mentors until I did start to have some kind of success.
Yeah, that humility of asking for help has played a big role in my life. People ask me, how the hell did you lose over $100 million? I didn't ask for help. You know, some simple, now that I'm 58 years old, looking back, there were some simple things I didn't do that would have protected and promoted me. But for me, I needed to learn those lessons. I needed to fail and get that feedback for the long run. What's one of the lessons that you needed to learn from the 99 to 2019 that you needed to learn before you could get to 660 or more, you know, locations?
For me, the big thing was learning to attract the right people, learning to trust the right people. I can't do any of it. It's not me. It's a whole team. It's my wife and kids at home. It's the team at work. So for me, it's, you can't control everything yourself. You're probably going to find somebody who's better at it than you are. You gotta trust them and let them speak from their experience. And I was always trying to attract people that have done things that I hadn't did so that I would be able to learn almost from the people that were on my team. And I think at first it took me a while to do that. I tell the story of, I used to obsess over things like if there's a light bulb out, it would bother me because I wanted things to be that perfect.
Yeah. I've been there.
You can't scale and do that. So you have to learn to, like, accept that 90% of what you could do if it was just you is probably better than most. And the way I kind of look at things now is you want things to be perfect always, but I'm not perfect. Nobody's perfect. Nothing's perfect. What you want to be is better than the guy next to you. As long as your business can beat the same competing business next to you, you're gonna do so well. And so losing those perfection goals is something that takes a little bit.
Yeah, I took the same philosophy when I went to Kenya on my first safari. Everyone's like, you got to be faster than that lion. I said, no, nope, I just got to be faster than that guy. I'll be fine. Mm-hmm. Not perfect, though.
You make mistakes, honestly, they're the best chance to win people over. If I made a mistake with an employee and I learned so much then from that experience and it was my chance to make it right. Or to this day, if we upset a customer, they want to they want to know that their voice is heard and that you can fix their problem and just be responsive. And if you can win that, you'll usually win that customer over and they'll be a customer for life just because you're responsive to their concerns.
I could not agree more that there's so much opportunity when you make mistakes.
You gain so much more loyalty when you make it right.
Yeah, exactly. And most people don't, right? They go to blame, shame, and justification. They don't ask, what did I do to be responsible? What did I do to attract this? What am I doing to participate in this perception that somehow we're not at fault?
Right.
And when you take the position of this was done, this mistake has happened, how can I be of service or value to fix it? You will have a customer, not only customer for life, you'll have someone that not only buys from you for life, but sells for you for
tells
life.
Everybody else
people
about
tells
it.
Those, you're not going to believe what happened. They screwed this up, but I got this because of it and they did this and they were amazing. That's what people want to know. Now, you talked about talent acquisition, talent development, talent retention, which is a big part of your success are the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I learned in my own marriage that I've applied to my business is I try to be that which I want the other person to be. So like I tried to be the wife I wanted. So like the actions I had,
yeah,
and it changed everything. Like instead of like wanting my wife to do stuff, it was like I started just doing it and being that person, which really helped the relationship. I find the same thing's true. You can't do everything, but you can be the reactions you have, the leader you are, the humility that exists. People are watching you. You have how many thousands of employees you have?
Between 10 and 11,000. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot of people that you don't get to talk to. They're not really listening to you, but they all have their eye on you, especially when you're doing content and things like this. So how important is it to walk the walk and be what you want others to become?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, part of the reason for doing this, this whole concept, why I'm sitting in front of you and why
next
do
to
any next to you, sorry, and do any kind of podcasting started from internally trying to figure out, look, 650 location, all these people, it's going to be years before I get in front of some of them. How can they get to know me? I miss the days when it was a couple shops and I knew everybody closely. So this started with a way to message them.
Yes, now, not even people. One of the people here recognized the shop and was giving a location.
Yeah.
And I can see you going through your head like, do I know that location?
Exactly right. Have
crazy.
I been there? Yes.
Exactly.
Exactly right. And this question was around the way we treat
become,
people.
Yeah, you want to be what you want others to become.
Yeah, you can't be phony, not in this world, to call it out. And one thing's for sure, I don't walk around, I'll openly talk about my flaws. In fact, those are the more interesting conversation. Yeah. People want to know you're real. For me to get here and say, I have this perfect company and everybody in it is perfect. Every process is perfect. Every result's perfect. It's nonsense. We're extremely flawed. We just are all about helping people in a time of need and doing everything we can to get it right. And I think if you come from that place, then it's hard to make major mistakes that do harm. And I'm the other learning for me is a little bit of I love your comments about be the wife I wanted to become. One thing I had to nuance that a little bit is not everybody wants to be treated exactly like I want to be treated.
Right.
So it became a little bit more than the golden rule, so to speak. It became how
yourself.
Do they want to be treated?
Yeah, I learned that as a young executive when I was like, I'm just treating people the way that I treat myself. And they're like, oh, everyone's going to quit because you're not nice to yourself. You're hard on yourself, right?
Yep.
And within the context, too, of learning, I am working on things at all times, right? I have coaches, mentors, and teachers. I'm into developing who I am because, like you said, you picked up on it right away. I'm better with my own money now, so the people around me are better with that. I'm more comfortable with that. So I work on a terrible need to be offended. I just work on it because my instant reaction is this idea, this person offended me for some silly reason. If you have a need to be offended, it will fulfill itself the minute you walk out the door. There's plenty of reasons to be offended. If I was going to ask you as a coach, a teacher, a mentor, what's the number one thing that you want to work on personally, not business-wise or, learn AI?
Personally, not business-wise, personally. I have a 6 and 9 year old. My daughter's about to be 7 in a couple weeks. So I have a 7 and 9 year old. And I think that that's where I embarrassingly feel like I have the most work to do. Like, there's not a playbook that I got. You know, my parents divorced early, so I didn't learn necessarily great fatherhood from experience. I've watched parents have success and not, but I feel like it's a little bit of figuring it out on your own. And I almost feel like you're almost doomed to mess it up. Like, even if you're the perfect parent, I feel like you might mess up your kids because you were the perfect parent.
Right.
But
that's a great insight.
it's really that personally, I feel like I want to get it right, just like everybody does, I assume. And I feel like I'm far short of that.
Yeah. Well, as a parent of 4, and 3 of them are a little bit older now, I will tell you that's the right perspective to take, right? We just do our best as parents, learn lessons, have fun. But one of the things for me that has carried over is just assigning time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we grow to the bees and the billions, if we're not conscious about what's non-negotiable with time,
yeah,
then we won't have an opportunity to do our best to learn lessons and have fun. We won't have enough time to have our kids watch us, you know, to pick up on the good and the bad. Like you said, it's probably not a good thing to be a perfect parent. That'll fuck up your kids worse than being a bad parent. Like, bad parent, at least you're empowering them. Perfect parents, you've created a bubble, and now they don't grow, right? Because they're not, they're too comfortable. So I think that's some great wisdom there. We were talking about next, when we get to a big business, you get a lot more options, opportunities when you are successful in business, because people want to place their money with you as customers, vendors, associates, marketers. Everybody wants to invest in what you're doing once it works.
Right.
And they all want to tell you, I told you could do it. But I have found in the stage that you're at, a little bit of paralysis happens when we have too many options and we lose sight on what we want in combination with what's best for the business.
Okay.
You've earned a right to have a say in what you want for the business, mm-hmm. but you also have to provide shareholder value. For you, how have you been able to reconcile your personal needs or wants versus shareholder value?
I view that as balancing the long-term and short-term interest of
timing, risk tolerance then.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so investors have a window in the private equity world. You know, there's this window of say 5 years that they want to invest the money and then get a return on it. So they can view things short-sighted sometimes in that regard. It's my role to make sure I balance that. How do I get that return and value for the shareholders and for myself personally as a shareholder, and do what's best for the business long-term? Sometimes they conflict, but there's usually, I mean, that's what the role is, to figure out how you do both. And so I've so far been able to balance it and eventually get what I need for the company to do great long-term and be able to create short-term value for the shareholder. And I also feel that comes from great communication. You have to communicate the vision. I keep learning and keep working on that, because the vision, the bigger things are, the more detail in the vision matters. You can't just say, I use this example. If I said to you, I want to go build a house, I have no clue what just came in your mind. You could be thinking of a house with a 1-car garage, a 4-car garage. It could be 1-story, 2-story. It could be 1,000 square feet. It could be 20,000 square feet. All those details matter if I want you to share the vision that I have. I work constantly at articulating the details of the vision, both to the team and to the board and to the shareholders, because they can't see it if you don't articulate it well. That's something that I learned, because I used to be terrible at it, and I'd get frustrated. And then I would hear they wouldn't approve what I wanted to do, for example. And what I would do is go home, I table it, I go home and basically tell myself, you didn't sell it well enough. You know it's a great idea. If they're giving you resistance, it's because you didn't articulate it, you didn't sell it well enough. And I keep working on that.
Last question. 1999, what advice would you give yourself looking back? And in 2019, what advice would you give yourself looking back? and which one would have a greater impact on your life?
Wow. It might be the same advice. And the advice would be embrace the problems, embrace the struggle. I think I spent a lot of years trying to eliminate struggle.
Yeah.
And that's where the opportunity lies. If there were no problems to solve, if there was, so that would be it. And then trust the plan, be adaptable. But really, it's not trying to run from the problems or avoid it. It's embrace it. And if you figure out a way to solve it, you're probably on to something.
If you would have told yourself that advice at 19 or 99 or 19, which one would have had the more impact? Knowing that in 99 or knowing that in 19?
I feel it has to be 99 because you have more time.
Yeah.
Like the value of time is, look at
that distance of resistance that you created.
Part of Warren Buffett's success, he would say, right, is the years that he was at it. And so if I had the knowledge that I had, all of us do that. Forget me and you. Everybody says, if I knew now. If I knew
Monday
as a teenager then, right?
Man. Exactly.
Yeah, so
well, we're more than a Monday morning quarterback here with incredible CEOs and founders. Like my friend, the amazing Matt Ebert, I will tell you that there's a lot to learn. That pain, to me, struggle, pain, I used to say is an indicator. Now I call it the communicator. Whenever there's pain, it's just communicating what I need to work on. If I have back pain, for example,
a great outlook.
I know I need to work on my back. If it's employee pain, I have to work on my employees. Regardless of the pain, struggles, setbacks, and failures that both Matt Ebert and I have experienced, there's one thing that we share in common, that we both have learned to enjoy the consistent, everyday, persistent, without quit, pursuit of our potential. $3 billion company, the CEO of Crash Champions, Matt Ebert, thanks for joining me here at the National Restaurant Association Show. I'm David Meltzer. This is Entrepreneurs, the Playbook.